This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight's show is a little bit different, in the fact that we are going to be splitting it into two shows due to the length. Our guest tonight and next week is David Politis. Now, David has, he's uncovered something rather unusual, rather disturbing, actually. And I feel this is something important that people really should be paying more attention to. David has found a pattern of missing people in and around national parks. There's no good explanation for what's happening to these people. And as you'll hear tonight, if you're unfamiliar with the subject, it's rather puzzling. There are unusual patterns. There are unusual elements to this that just shouldn't be there. Now, on the surface, you may say, well, it's a national park. Someone might have gotten dragged off by a wild animal, fallen off a cliff, and that happens. That's not what this is. In the end, you need to read these books to really understand the depth of it. No interview is going to give you the full story. We can discuss it, we can get into it, but you're still never going to get the full extent of what's actually going on here, the depth of these patterns and this mystery. And on that topic, do not buy these books from Amazon. These books are not officially for sale on Amazon. If you go to Amazon, you will pay at least double, if not much more than that, for the books. The books can be purchased at canammissing.com. That's like CanadianAmericanMissing.com. They cost you no more than $25. On Amazon, you're looking at anywhere from $50 to $100. These are people buying them from canammissing.com and then reselling them on Amazon. So if you want the books, buy them from canammissing.com. Or, David has said he has made these available many times to public libraries. So see if you can get them from the library if you don't want to buy them. There are 4 books now. Like with anything, people make a lot of assumptions when it comes to this material. David and I try to clear that up at the beginning of this interview. Then we get into some of the cases, some of the new cases from his latest book, The Devils in the Detail. Also called Missing 411. All 4 books are called Missing 411. And we cover a lot of mysteries on this show. And this one has me completely dumbfounded. I'm really, honestly not sure what to make of it. I think David has found something legitimate. And a reader of his books has actually started a petition. And we'll talk about that a little bit with David. But you can go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. If you're listening to this live, it'll be on the main page. If you're listening to this in an archive, there will be a link to that petition. That petition can also be found on canammissing.com. And the text of it reads this. Currently, there is no centralized registry or database of persons who have gone missing in our national parks and forests or on Bureau of Land Management lands. If search and rescue parties are unable to locate the missing, no records are required to be kept by our government about the missing person case or the circumstances surrounding the event. When remains of the missing are found, again, no records are required to be maintained. It is time to demand that a national publicly accessible registry database be created in which all missing persons are accounted for in our national parks and forests and on BLM lands. The purpose of this would be to make the government accountable for keeping track of the missing, to inform the public of the facts surrounding missing person cases on public lands, as well as keeping account of all missing individuals and the circumstances under which they went missing on public lands. This is something that should have already been done. The fact that it is not is at very least neglectful. In the past on the show, we have done multi-part interviews. This one was actually done as one part, and I'm splitting into two, because it runs well over 2 hours. Next week, we will air part two of this interview. And the week after that, I hope to be airing our Listener Paranormal Stories show. If you have a paranormal story you want to share, you can get in touch with us, and I can either record you telling the story, or if you wish, as some people have, write out the story, and I will read the story on the air. So that'll be the last show of this year. So we have two here with David Politis, and then that one. So get in touch very soon if you'd like to contribute to the Paranormal Encounters show. And with that, here is part one of my interview with David Politis. All right, David, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Soraya. I appreciate it. Always a good time with you.
All right, and your latest book is Missing 411, The Devil's in the Detail. And when did this come out?
Probably 8-9 months ago.
Okay. And how's the response been to this? Any different than the other ones?
Some of the bigger names, like the guys on Coast to Coast, have said it's one of the best books I've ever done, but I think they're always too polite. I think that this one encompasses a few more things, but on the opposite end of the scale, I always tell people that the books were written in a way to make sense to the reader as a progressive work. So if you go straight for this book, it won't make a lot of sense because you got to have some background on the topic.
Yeah. Yeah, and it definitely brings a little more depth to the topic as well. How much time do you spend researching some of these cases?
Well, that's a tough subject to answer, because when I'm waiting for reports from sheriff's departments, coroners, et cetera, search and rescue teams, sometimes those take weeks to get. Other times I can get them pretty quick, but then also there's an online search and going out there a lot of times to just get a feel for the area and interview people. It's some of these things take, you know, a long time to put together.
And that's what I was going to ask you. Do you actually go out to the areas when possible?
Yes. I think that's a very revealing thing for me, and it helps me understand, you know, the distances, the dynamics of how far the person might have traveled, et cetera. It helps me get a visual for it, so when I put it to paper, it's a little easier for me to do.
Yeah, it's a little more detailed than just looking at Google Maps.
Yeah, well, you know, think about 20 years ago when we didn't have anything like that, and how you can't get that visual representation that we can today.
True. And when you interview people, who do you try to interview?
I usually try to get a hold of the detective or the sheriff or the national parks person that was on scene, that was in charge of the original investigation. And if I can't get them, then a lot of times I'll get somebody in the area who knew about it, who maybe talked to another reporter. Their name was listed, so I'll go out and get them. Sometimes it's the reporter himself or herself that wrote the article that's a part of the story. And, you know, we're going to talk about something today where a reporter actually got to be part of the story in a national park case. So,
Right. And how often do you get to talk to the family members?
So that's something that I don't do by practice. And I get a lot of questions about this. Why don't you just, you know, essentially go for the throat, get the family member? Well, when we first started this, you know, there's an old saying in research and investigations, don't retread someone's work and learn from their mistakes. So I called a couple of different missing persons organizations, told them what we were about to do, and asked them for direction. And one of the things that almost every group said was, don't talk to the victim or their family if you're going to write a book, because they will feel as though they're being victimized a second or maybe a third time. And
right.
I don't want any bad press. I don't want people to think negatively. So if they proactively come and talk to me, I'm all in. I'll go there.
And that has happened a few times.
It has. On the Atadero case, myself and Alan Atadero, Jared's dad are really good friends now, and he's a great man. And he approached me after he read the book, and he said, "Dave, you're one of the only guys that got the story all correct, and and we're willing to say it." And then the other one that we did, and we did it because we thought it was really a make it or break it to part of the case, was approaching Mr. Martin on the Dennis Martin case, and we did, and we got the interview where nobody else could, so that was important.
Right, and a lot of people, I've seen comments here and there where people will, like, look up a couple of articles on the internet and be like, "Well, I solved this. David just didn't understand the case," when you're the one going out there talking to the people, actually walking the terrain. And it's very easy for people to dismiss this if they don't realize the amount of work you've put into actually researching these things.
Well, and one of those great examples of exactly that is the Cullen Finnerty case out of Michigan. And I get a lot of emails saying, "Well, didn't you see this? That, you know, he had all these mental issues." Hey, it's all irrelevant. We're talking about a specific incident, the facts surrounding that incident. And if you understand the facts, the peripheral aspects of people trying to demean him or his family are completely irrelevant. And while you look at his personality as a whole, that maybe something outside occurred, the facts of the Finnerty case was it's so far outside the bounds of normal life. And when two different groups of medical examiners can't determine a cause of death, there's something really strange going on.
Yeah, and that mental issues don't explain that.
No.
Now, one of the things you quote from a lot is Robert Koester's book, Lost Person Behavior. Why did you pick that book?
So I gave a talk a couple years ago in front of the largest search and rescue organization in the world. It's a group called NASAR. I presented our findings there. And Koester's one of those noted experts that people, search and rescue people, use to set their grid lines and search patterns when people disappear. And they view him as an expert, so I'm going to follow their lead. I'll view him as an expert. So if people want to say, "Oh, you know, that's real normal for a two-year-old to be found 6 miles away and 2,000 feet up," you know, that's not what Koester's research did. And, you know, if you look at other things that have happened, I don't think that's going to work. So a lot in my books, I will point to other people who have done research beyond me and know more about these things in that specific area, or I will give someone else's opinion about something specific. And rarely will I come out with a strong and wrong stance on something other than saying, "Well, you know, this seems pretty far outside the bounds of what I knew my kids could do."
Right, right. Now, you've spoken in front of search and rescue groups, right?
Yep.
And how do they take this stuff?
So that is pretty funny. Publicly, if I'm in a, say I'm in a group of 20 of them, and I bring up a topic, as a whole, they'll kind of push it away and offer some subliminal resistance. One-on-one, they'll come up and they'll say, "Oh, this has been going on for years. We know about it, blah, blah, blah." Well, at the NASAR conference, I don't know how many hundreds of people were in the room, but two different Alaska state troopers stood up and they said, "Dave, we all know in this room, if we've been doing this for more than 10 years, this is something we've seen many times. We don't know what's going on. We're not sure what's happening. But a lot of people in this room are just afraid to say it. But you're saying what a lot of people don't want to say." And since then, I've gotten a lot of emails from search and rescue people, a lot out of Washington specifically, saying that they've encountered strange things while searching for missing people, that they've felt the same things I've explained in books, that the circumstances behind certain search and rescues weren't as the sheriff released in his news release, but there were other things, and they would talk about it to me. So this is one of those topics that a lot of people are uncomfortable talking about, but if you look at the overwhelming evidence, and again, you can't be an expert by listening to my radio interviews and videotapes that have been made by various people, because that scratches the surface on the topic. But if you read the books and you look at it at its entirety, you're going to see quickly that there's a series of patterns that will just hit you in the face.
Now, have you had any search and rescue people upset with your work?
No, none that have told me.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned before that you sometimes have trouble getting police reports or information through Freedom of Information Acts.
So certain states have something like the Freedom of Information Act. Like the state of Washington is a mandatory disclosure state. And so if it's not an ongoing criminal investigation, I've gotten cases every time out of Washington. Other states like California, no, it isn't mandatory disclosure. They can kind of hold back whenever they want. Now, today I got an interesting email from a guy named Dave, like my name. But he said, you know, Dave, he says the government can't withhold this information under the Freedom of Information Act because there's a law that says they have to release this. And you have to take a stronger stance on this and demand disclosure. And while I agree 100% with what he says, the reality is that our government is going to withhold reports on a variety of topics, no matter what we do. And then my guess is that when we get them to force disclosure, if we go that far, we've seen in the past, the government says, oh, those were destroyed, we lost them, we don't have them anymore. So while I'm there, and I would hope by now some government-level federal group of attorneys would pick this stuff up and say, hey, you know, we'll represent you, we'll go do it. So far, no one's done that, and maybe because they know that it's a huge uphill battle. But as of right now, the government is just flipping their nose at us and saying, no. You know, if you want this, it's going to cost you $34,000. Or yes, if you want this report, it's going to cost you $7,000. They know we're never going to pay it.
Right. Wow. So what do you want to outline for people some of the patterns in these missing cases, what makes them so unusual?
So for starters, about 99.5 or 99.9% of the cases we've written about, canines can't pick up a scent. And it's across the board, whether it's an old body that's been there for weeks or a month, and you bring in cadaver dogs, they can't pick up a scent. Whether it's a fresh trail, dogs can't pick up a scent on these. And the behavior is sometimes they walk in a circle and lay down. Sometimes they walk up the trail 10 feet, stop, and sit down. It's a pretty common theme. They never either don't want to work, are afraid to work, or there is no scent to pick up. That's probably the most common one. Another one is that after the person disappears or as the event is unfolding, bad weather moves in, meaning rain, snow, wind, sometimes it's fog. One case I wrote about, there was a huge dust storm. Something happens where it causes a huge issue to people coming in to do the search, meaning tracks will be covered up, scent won't be able to be found as easily, et cetera, et cetera. It's befuddling, and we didn't quite understand it or see it in the first 100 cases, but by the time we got to the 1,000th case, there's no doubt these are some pretty common themes.
And they're very weird things too.
They are. I mean, and it doesn't matter if you're on the water, you're in the air, you're on the ground. These things are going to happen, it seems. And, you know, some of the people that may be listening to this interview for the first time say, oh, come on, you know, this sounds like crap or, but the reality of it is that if you read the books, and my books deal with facts, and facts are important, then you follow the facts, and it'll just level you that the number of times this stuff happens. The other one is a lot of people disappear in boulder fields or around granite. In an unusual number of cases that I've written about in a book, there's a whole chapter on it, people disappear when they're picking berries. That seems like a very strange thing.
Yeah.
And then the overwhelming one is it doesn't matter if you're in the United States, Canada, or on international cases, national parks, whether it's in a national park in Australia, a national park in Canada, or the U.S., people disappear in national parks fitting our profile an abnormal number of times. And the biggest cluster of missing people in the world is Yosemite National Park. And if you stick strictly to the profile that we've established, Yosemite sticks out like a sore thumb. In North America, there are 52 clusters of missing people. So you know, whether that's coincidence or however that came about, they're there. And if you look at the U.S. map or cluster map, it's right down the middle of the United States. There are essentially no disappearances.
Yeah, and that's really strange. I was just gonna mention that. You have a lot on the West Coast. It kind of goes around the West Coast and down the Rockies and then up and down the East Coast. But along the central U.S., there's almost nothing.
Yeah, if you follow the Appalachian Trail from south to north, the disappearances sort of are around the Appalachians as you go north up into the Adirondacks in New York, Maine, and up towards Canada. And then there's a series of disappearances that completely surround the Great Lakes. And then the Rocky Mountains, the Pacific Coast. And we just sat down, we were having a big discussion about this the other day, and it sticks out to us is that mountains and water are the predominant features that are related to the disappearances. You look all around the Great Lakes, all the disappearances there are close proximity to the lakes. Up the Appalachian Trail up into New York, you got the eastern water area, eastern Atlantic, where the water's not that far away. The mountains of the Rockies, and then the Pacific Coast go right up the coast, not far from the Pacific Ocean at all. So,
and these, when I first heard you, I think it was when George Knapp interviewed you on Coast to Coast. It might have been your first time you talked about this. When it was announced that, you know, people are going missing in national parks, my initial response was, well, of course they are. There's wild animals, people, you know, fall off mountains, so on and so forth. But after listening to you, I realized that's not what you're talking about here.
No. And again, you and I could spend the next 2 hours, 3 hours talking about the consistent elements and the profiles and how they fit in. But the people, the locations where they disappear are odd. The fact that the people aren't found is odd. The amount of effort that goes into the search for those first 7 days would seem like a pretty good effort. But then after that seventh, eighth day, there is no more effort. There's no follow-up. There's nothing done to find the person. It's like they knew to give up, and they're going to give up, and that's it. And a lot of these, an important element to us almost from the very beginning that we understood is that those clusters, there's also historical significance to these. And the ones that, say, aren't in big national parks, like that are where there are a lot of disappearances, Rainier, for example, there's a historical fact there that disappearances have been occurring there, strange ones, for years and years and years. And same with Yosemite, same with Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and Rocky Mountain National Park. The disappearances there on the face may seem normal, but when you get into the minutiae of the data, you say, well, this person was with a church group. They were in Yosemite. They were up at the falls. They're walking back, and this guy was at the back of the line. He never made it to the bottom. They spent a week searching for him. Dogs never picked up a scent. Cadaver dogs never picked up a scent. He was a large person, possibly severely overweight. Where did he go? Why wasn't he found? And other times, one case in Yosemite, a woman disappears when she was with her fiancé. They originally pointed the finger at him. He passed a series of polygraphs. They find her weeks later down a valley, up a granite hill, in a river so far away that it took rock climbers to get in there to find her. When the press asked him how she got there, they said, we have no idea how she got there. Or better yet, how she even disappeared from where she was with her fiancé.
Right. Now, when you're talking clusters, too, I think people need to know that these clusters aren't like a group of people disappeared in 1980. These go back from the 1800s, sometimes have decades in between the disappearances, but they're in the same area with the same type of information surrounding them.
Exactly. I mean, one of the oldest disappearances we have going back to 1760. And when you read that case, it matches the facts of a case during the 21st century exactly.
Yeah.
And you think, how could that happen? Just recently, within the last year or so, we've identified a group of scholarly types that have disappeared. Namely, there have been five physicists that have disappeared in recent times. I mean, really disappeared, and they weren't found. Most recent one is a German physicist that was visiting Southern California, Lake Arrowhead area, disappeared on a hiking trail, last in line. A lot of people have made some sense of this, saying, well, if you're last in line while you're hiking, you know, you have the least chance of getting back. And I would say, oh, no, that's not the case. But in reality, when you read the reports, the person who is last in line, something happens. The again, for the first-time listener, they're going to say, well, this could have been an animal attack. Well, one of the things with an animal attack is people are going to fight. They don't just give up and die. And when you fight, you yell, you scream. There's going to be blood. There's going to be hair. There's going to be big disruption in the soil around there. And the animal smell and your smell is going to be all over that area for a tracker to pick up, and these searches have trackers pick up and follow that path. So in every one of the cases that we do, animal attack has been ruled out, mental illness or suicide has been ruled out, and drowning has been ruled out. So these cases that I've written about to this point, there aren't a lot of options that searchers have left for what happened.
And one of the things people will throw out there is it must be a serial killer. But obviously, you don't have a serial killer killing in all these different locations over centuries.
Exactly. I mean, you got 52 locations in North America. And in addition, I've identified locations in Australia, New Zealand, and in other UK, say, where the same sort of cookie-cutter disappearance and facts surrounding it exist.
Yeah. And now you have started a petition, and let's get into that real quick. This is to get some of these national parks to do what?
So I actually didn't start it, but it was one of the readers of my books, and the title of it is Make the Department of the Interior Accountable for Persons Missing in Our National Parks and Forests. And how that came about was, early in our research, we knew that the national parks had a lot of missing people. And we went to the parks and we said, under the Freedom of Information Act, we'd like a list of people missing from Yosemite. Several weeks later, an attorney calls me and says, why do you want the info? And I said, well, we're doing some research, blah, blah, blah. And he says, well, we don't have it. If you want that list, it's going to cost you $34,000. And I said, well, isn't that information you should be keeping anyhow? And he goes, well, we don't think that's important. We rely on the quote-unquote institutional knowledge of our employees for that. Well, that's pretty bizarre, because employees move around a lot in the National Park Service. So that was for Yosemite. And then I'm thinking to myself, let's make it real ridiculous and ask them for the list of people from their entire system. And he says, oh, that'll be, they got back to me weeks later and said that would be $1.4 million. So most medium and large police departments in Canada and the U.S. have a list of all the missing people from their jurisdiction on their site. And the National Park Service, which is one of the largest federal law enforcement contingencies in the United States and has one of the biggest handprints because it stretches all over the United States, that federal law enforcement institution doesn't talk about missing people at all. They don't want you to know how many people have been missing from an area, and they do everything possible to keep that information from the public.
Now, they also don't count someone as missing if they presume them dead, correct?
That's a bizarre fact that I found early in our research that, again, they don't want to talk about. If they say, oh, you know, the person disappeared in a snowstorm and they searched for 2 weeks, they can't find him, and at the end of the winter he still hasn't surfaced, well, he's missing, he's presumed dead, he's no longer missing, so he's off the books.
And that cuts down their list of missing people.
Absolutely, and that's another reason why you won't see their lists on a lot of databases.
Wow. All right, well, let's get into one of these cases so we can give people who are not familiar with this a taste of exactly what's going on here. And I think Margaret Turner is possibly one of the best examples of this.
Very, very strange case. And this one was lucky that we found it, because it didn't get a lot of press internationally or nationally at the time. But in southern Colorado, in Durango, October 9th, 1924, Margaret Turner, 20 months old, and I want to stop right there for a second and say, if you're a parent and you've raised a couple kids, you understand how long a 20-month-old can travel on 2 feet. And there's a lot of 20-month-olds that can't even walk. But some can. And let's see, how far could a 20-month-old travel? Well, Margaret was at her residence. It's in a rural area outside the fringe of Durango. And there was a lonely dirt road coming up to their house. And the mom said somehow Margaret disappeared from the home. And she thought she was inside the home but wasn't positive. So there's not a lot of places to go. There's not a lot of neighbors. There's not a lot out there. Well, the La Plata County Sheriff responded, and right away they couldn't find anything. And they got concerned, and they asked for volunteers to assist. And they even got the all of the high schools in the area to close late that afternoon and the next day to help looking for Margaret and get those volunteers out in the field. Well, in a very strange turn of events, the following day, there were a couple of guys from the local high school, and they were putting the volunteers on the outside perimeter of the search zone. So the primary area you'd be searching for somebody of that age is within a mile, maybe within 2 miles, but not outside of 2 miles. Because how far could a 20-month-old travel? You got to think about that.
Right.
So these guys were at the 5-mile marker, and to me it sounded like they were just out for a hike, kind of looking around, you know, doing what kids do. And the Milwaukee Journal had this article about it, says, and this is what it says. It says, being barely able to walk, however, Sheriff Rose said it would have been impossible for the baby to have scaled the heights where she was found and to survive a night of cold as she did. There was no shelter. The spot where she was found was sparsely overgrown with scrub oak. Now, she was found 5 miles away on top of a peak with no road access to the peak. So I've had people read this and say, well, she was abducted from her house and somebody took her and dropped her off there. And 20 years in law enforcement, I can tell you that dog doesn't hunt. And the reason being is that if someone's going to abduct a child, what they're going to do is they're going to drop them at the fastest place they can and get away as quick as they can. Well, in Durango, there's a lot of rural highways that go into the middle of the mountains, and you'd dump her on the side of the road and you'd be gone. You wouldn't climb to the top of a mountain and drop her off knowing that there's searchers all over that area looking for her. And the sheriff said that that girl wasn't there the night before because she couldn't have lived through it. So searchers believe that Margaret was placed there probably, you know, early that morning, too cold to survive the previous night. And he said, the sheriff said it was obvious to him that the kidnapper, it was a kidnapping. Now, the important part to this, to me, and to readers of my past books, is that this fits this profile of a child disappearing from their residence. I've written about this a lot. Now, there's no way Mrs. Turner wouldn't have heard a car coming up her dirt road, because when you live in that rural area, sounds are pretty easy to come by. You could hear that car coming. So I don't believe a car came down that road and took her. The question is how she got 5 miles away, survived the night, where was she during the night, and how fortunate she was that she was found by some of these boys on top of this peak and didn't fall off the peak and die. Now, there's another case that I wrote about in my first book that occurred in July 2nd, 1938. It was a boy named Alfred Buellartz, who was 4 years old. He was in Rocky Mountain National Park. He and his dad were hiking along a trail. He disappeared. A couple days later, some witnesses were walking down a trail miles away, and they're sitting down and they're taking a break, and they look up above them on a cliff, and they see, a husband and wife see this little boy sitting on the edge of this rock precipice looking kind of down at them. Well, they don't know a little kid had disappeared, but they're going, what parent in their right mind would let a kid do that? And they said, and all of a sudden the kid was jerked back. Well, they get back down to the bottom, and there's thousands of people searching for this kid. They get home, and they look at the picture on the front page of the Denver Post at the time, and they look at each other and say, that's the boy we saw up there on that cliff. So they went back to the park. Originally, the park accused them that they were involved until they figured out they were good people. They saw what they saw. And the point to that story is that the place where they saw Alfred as a location called Devil's Nest. And it took 2 days for a group of specialty climbers from the Park Service to work their way into that location. He wasn't there, but that point being is that somehow these kids are getting into locations that we normally, as adults, would have a difficult time getting into at the very best. But these young kids are seen in these locations, and there's no answer how they got there.
And Devil's Nest, that brings up the place names. And this is something that other researchers have pointed out before. Andrew Collins has pointed it out, that areas that have these names like Devil's Nest tend to have some odd phenomena associated with them.
So I haven't done a lot of research on that end, but I will tell you, as I did in this book, that the word devil and other names that have negative connotations seem to come up with disappearances an abnormal amount of time, as this Devil's Nest did, as the name The Devil's in the Detail, this latest book. So that title had double meaning, that, yeah, the devil, that name is used a lot in the locations where these people disappear or are found, and the detail is important.
Yeah, and you got to figure these places were named that for a reason.
Exactly. If we could really know why they were named that way, that would be fascinating.
And most of these places, obviously, those names go back further than we have records as to who named them or why.
Absolutely.
Where can people go to sign your petition, by the way?
So if you go to our website, Can-Am Missing, C-A-N as in Nora, A-M as in Mary, missing.com, there's a link there where you can get to it. And we're trying to get upwards of 10,000 signatures, and we're about a little more than quarter of the way there. So every signature counts, and we'd appreciate it if you did sign it.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to, I think it's Mitchelldale Stelling.
Yes. Yes. As we talked about earlier, when the reporter becomes part of the story, it's kind of interesting. One of the things that I didn't talk about earlier, but I meant to, was that another part of the equation on the profile is you have intellectuals on one side of that fence that are disappearing that we've identified. On another side of the fence are people with disabilities or people that have maybe health issues that aren't visible outwardly, but when you talk to the family, they did and they were severe. So Mitchelldale Stelling, 51 years old, he and his wife were going to take a trip to various national parks and national forests. And by a very strange sort of events, their motorhome broke down and they were sort of stuck for a while at Mesa Verde National Park in southern Colorado. This is a recent case. This is June 9th, 2013, about 4:08 p.m. So while their motorhome was getting serviced and worked on, he and his wife, Denine, decided to go into the park and look around. So Mitchell had a history of a really bad back. I mean, severely injured. He was disabled. And his wife was a nurse. So for people who don't know, Mesa Verde sits at the southwest corner of Colorado, kind of in the Four Corners area. It was the home of the Pueblo Indians from 600 AD to about 1300. There's 5,000 archaeological sites, about 600 cliff dwellings in that park. And Theodore Roosevelt dedicated the park June 29, 1906. The interesting thing about the park is that the historians don't have any idea why the Native Americans left or how they left this area, because there was a huge habitation there. But they left and they disappeared. So the Stellings decided to they'd hang out, look around, and they were kind of standing around the park. And Mitchell says at about 4 o'clock on June 9th, that he was going to take the trailhead where they were standing and climb the trail a quarter of a mile to see a dwelling not that far away. And it was a hot afternoon, and his wife says, okay, I'll be right here. He says, yeah, I won't be very long. So he takes a walk, and at 7 o'clock that night, he still hadn't come back. So his wife gets hold of the National Park Service, and right away they start a search and rescue, and they start going up the trails. Now, Mitchell isn't one of these kind of guys that's going to go off trail. He's not going to start climbing, etc. The guy is, you know, he could probably barely walk. So they all expected to find him quickly, you know, maybe dehydrated or something sitting on the trail. Well, they didn't find him that day. And that night they didn't find him. Well, as that kind of the next day comes around, there was a reporter that was coming to the park headquarters to interview the superintendent on another issue entirely. But as she gets there, she sees all of the commotion, and she gets a hold of the superintendent and is told about the disappearance. And he goes, you know, come back later and we'll have more of a discussion about what you were here to talk about. And so she takes a walk and goes up the Petroglyph Trail and kind of goes along, and she doesn't really know where she's going, but she's just kind of walking along, trying to waste some time. And as she's walking along, she hears a man's voice say, "I need some help." And she said it was real clear. She couldn't pinpoint the exact location, but she walked around a little bit. And she goes, it was distinct. It was clear. She said she didn't see anybody around her. She didn't hear anybody else around her. Nothing. So she goes back, and as she comes back down the hill, she sees the chief ranger, and she reports to him where she was and what she heard. Now, the interesting part about that is that the chief ranger kind of turns white, and he goes, "Do you know that the searchers late yesterday were in that same area and heard the same thing?" And so they committed more resources to that area, didn't find anything, and as of this date, you know, we're way over a year later, they've never found him.
Yeah. And it seems like if he was stuck somewhere that they just couldn't see, eventually they'd smell him.
Well, you know, again, it goes back to the canines. Canines would have picked up a scent originally.
Yeah.
Cadaver dogs would have picked up a scent post. And if you were stuck somewhere or lost, hey, you'd be yelling and screaming. It'd be a nonstop barrage of voices for people trying to find you.
Right, right. Now, are there any legends in that area that talk about people disappearing?
Well, other than the entire group of Pueblo Indians.
Right. Do you find that there are legends attached to any of these places, any of these centers?
As an example, Craters of the Moon National Monument in Idaho, I wrote about that there were some legends about people who disappeared in that area. And Crater Lake National Park, the Native Americans wouldn't go into that area because there were legends about it being a bad and devilish place to be. And there seems to be the more time you spend, the more you find out about these areas that there might be a little more at play than we understand.
And we should also point out that there's nothing paranormal necessarily associated with these disappearances. People aren't seeing UFOs or anything like that in connection with these people disappearing now, are they?
You know, if they are, they're not saying it. And I should point out that in these official documents that I get, it's never going to say anything like that.
True.
But as an example, on the Atadero case, it was a very sterile report. But the more I started to talk to people and I started to go to secondary and third sources, then you start to realize there's a lot more at play here than what's in that report. And I would tend to believe that the more of these cases that exist, where somebody could go in and spend a month or 2 months on each case, you're probably going to find a lot more interesting things than first meets the eye.
Yeah, and it seems like the more cases you come up with, the harder it is to really come up with any kind of explanation. It seems like there may be more than one thing going on. I mean, some of the cases, it very well could be there's a prosaic prosaic explanation at some point. But so many of them, I mean, some of them look like someone was kidnapped, like the first one we talked about, Margaret Turner. Whereas others look like maybe people just wandered out of the world somewhere.
Well, every once in a while, I'll get an email from somebody who says, "Oh, you know, this is pretty easy. I've got this figured out." And of course, it's always someone who hasn't read the books, who listens to one interview, and maybe even just catches the story I just said about Stelling and says, "Well, he just walked into some kind of, you know, transformational tunnel or time warp, and he disappeared, and he can still see the ground, but he's asking for help." Well, just like you said, there's a lot of different points to this star. And yeah, there is this underlying element that, you know, consistent factors, but none of those factors to me at this point clearly spell out who's at fault or what is happening. And I think that's the big hook, is what is going on, because I don't think it's normal. And so other people would say, well, if it's not normal, it's got to be paranormal.
Right. Or it's just something that we're overlooking that we just wouldn't even think of as being an explanation is another possibility.
Well, and that was brought up just the other day as well. And another thing I talk about in the books is that many of the people that are found, they can't figure out a cause of death. And
right.
I have some very close friends that are in the medical field, and they have all stated, well, that doesn't mean there isn't a cause of death, and we're just not smart enough yet to figure out what it is. But it's not probably a conventional cause.
Fair enough. And there are people who are found alive, and I think a good example of this was Stephen Rowan Griffith.
Yeah, and, you know, it is those rare times where someone is found and they can actually explain something that makes a little bit of sense.
Now, this was a case where the mother contacted you, right?
Yeah, and that's pretty unusual, but this woman had heard from some of her friends that we had done work on missing people, and she says, you know, Dave, she says, I don't know all the facts in your books, but let me tell you what happened, and wow, I almost fell over. It was an exact cookie cutter of what we've talked about in the past, and where her son disappeared was in close proximity to other disappearances I've written about in the past. This occurred in an area of Richmond, New Hampshire, October 9th, 2010, two-year-old Stephen Griffin. So he was at his grandparents' house with his dad and some other people at a family party. It's about 6.8 miles southwest of where a three-year-old boy named Lewis Denton disappeared in 1947. Well, Stephen was in the backyard, kind of hanging around everybody, chasing a cat. And then all of a sudden, people realize he's not there. And this is what happens. People all of a sudden, and that's almost word for word, yeah, we just realized he wasn't there. And they start searching, and pretty soon they get scared. They call for help, and they're all over. I mean, they can't figure out what happened to the kid because he's not that big, 2 years old. So searchers come in, and the reports and the press stated he was found clinging to a tree in a swamp 11 hours after he disappeared. And it said that searchers had to wade up to their knees or deeper to get to him, to where he was located. Now remember, he's 2 years old. How did he get in the middle of a swamp hanging to a tree? And they asked him where his sweatshirt was, and he stated that it was in a tree somewhere. And then they asked him where his shoes were, or they found his shoes first, and then later they found him. And that's another thing. A lot of people are found without certain clothing or without shoes. An unusual thing he stated was that while he was gone, he saw cows. Well, his dad and his grandpa said there aren't any cows for miles, so they don't even know what he was talking about. But if you take all those things in their entirety, seems impossible.
Yeah. And swamps play a big role in this, don't they?
Yes, especially on the East Coast. Whereas people on the West Coast are found around boulders and granite, people on the East Coast a lot of times are found in, near, or very close proximity to swamps. It's a very, very strange thing.
And you got to wonder why. What is it about swamps or boulder fields that are special that come up so often in these cases?
Well, you got to remember, if you're in a boulder field or you're in a swamp, tracks are concealed. Mm-hmm. You could hide something very large in a swamp. And boulders, I've heard a lot of theories and nothing really sticks to me, but there's a lot of strange sort of energy, according to some, that are in these boulder fields.
Well, I know, I think it's Iceland. They actually built roads around certain boulders because they felt that, like, earth elemental types live in the boulders and they'd be upset if they were disturbed.
Yeah, and that's one of those stories in Iceland that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. And I found this story about it, and sure enough, in the Iceland news, they talked about a major highway that was built around this boulder, this large boulder, because they didn't want to disrupt the spirits that lived inside the boulder.
And I think it's David Weatherly talks also about, in one of his books, maybe Strange Intruders, he talks about legends of also the same thing, boulder fields in this country, that little people inhabit them, it's steel people.
Well, there's one theory right there.
I mean, who knows what they mean by little people? That's obviously a cultural translation. But again, you're looking at a connection between missing people and boulder fields again.
Well, and I've spent a lot of time around Native Americans, and every Native American tribe has a belief that there are little people living in the woods around them, and they've lived around them for thousands of years.
Hmm. Well, speaking of little people, let's talk about the report you had from Hawaii.
Well, that was an interesting case in that I had a friend that went there, and she was on this van driving around the island, and there was this elder Hawaiian that was driving the van and had all of this really interesting information about the island and its history, and it happened to be on Maui. And she came back and said, "Dave, you got to talk to this guy." Because when it was over, she went and had this private conversation with him, and she knew about our work, and she asked him a lot of questions, and he says, "Oh, yeah, it's been going on here for a long time." And the story was, his name was Roy Erekaios, and he grew up on Hawaii. He grew up on a plantation near Lahaina, and on that plantation, he kind of talked about the way of life, and all the families had just a roof, electricity, and water, and the plantation owners, you were kind of stuck there with their money, and you couldn't go a lot of places. But he said that the little people lived in the mountains there, and they were called, he spelled the word H-U-N-E. He said they always were in the mountains. You rarely saw them, and the people tried to avoid them. And he said he never really wanted to know more about it, but he did know that they had always been there, and they were still there today. And when we started to talk about disappearances and missing people, he says, "Well, have you heard of King Kamehameha? He was the last king of the island." I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, you know, he was 7 feet tall." I said, "Yeah, I knew that." And that kind of goes back to a show that's on TV now about the giants in North America that people don't want to talk about, right?
Yep, with Hugh Newman and... I'm blanking on the other two brothers' names.
Right. So he made it a point to bring that up, but he said that there's something called night marchers in Hawaii, and they're warriors that are in a sort of purgatory, and they worked for the old guard of the royal family. And if one of the royal family members ever died, got attacked or something, then these warriors were kind of dealt out and they were killed, and they came back as night marchers. Now, what really struck me about this story is he said they marched down the creeks from the mountains. And if you were on a beach, you were supposed to strip naked and bury your head in your hands. Now, what's interesting about that is that a lot of the people that end up dying that I've written about, they're face down when they're found, and many of them don't have clothes on. And I thought, wow, that is just too amazing of a coincidence for it to be just pure coincidence. And he said, if you look up, you'll be taken or you'll die. And the nakedness is supposed to show your humility for the situation.
Which could be also an interpretation on something else that's actually going on but is connected.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it seems like shoes are the most common thing to be missing.
Yes, it does. And some people are going to say, well, you know, you lose your shoes along the way, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Between you and me, that's going to be one of the last things I'm going to lose.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're walking out in the woods or in some wilderness area, the main thing you're going to want is your shoes above all.
Right. So...
Go on.
No, and a lot of times the shoes are never found. And when you talk about searchers that are covering every square piece of ground, you'd think the shoes would be one of those things that eventually would be found by the searcher or by the dog teams that are trying to find and look for scent.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, people do lose other bits of clothes, but when they lose the shoes, it seems like you're walking through the wilderness, your feet would be just lacerated to all hell after a while, but they're not when they're found, are they?
No, not at all. And there's a couple of cases where you would think that there's... I wrote about a case out of Craters of the Moon National Monument where two women disappeared, and how did they get into the middle of this area where the super sharp rocks and et cetera, et cetera. And they weren't dressed for hiking and they weren't hikers, and it goes on and on. So yeah, the absence of shoes is a big deal, and that's why we talk about it a lot.
And what other clothes commonly disappear?
Oh, you know, you have shirts, pants.
So everything.
Everything.
Now, a lot of people will say, well, it's, related to hypothermia, but these aren't always in cold weather areas either.
Well, that's a part where that theory kind of, to me, goes out the window. The people aren't gone long enough, and they're found within a day, and, you know, they're found deceased, and they're missing everything. Well, and it's not that cold. It's not that hot, and it's just a tempered environment. It doesn't work.
One of the common things, as you mentioned earlier, is berries. Berries seem like such a weird, common thing. You've had cases where people have been found around berry fields, but so many people have disappeared picking berries. It almost doesn't make sense.
Well, as somebody told me not too long ago, that berries are one of the most nutritional things that we can get in the wild. I mean, there's almost everything about a berry is good for you. And they thought that that was unusual, but there's a couple of small clusters in Canada where everybody in that cluster was an elderly person picking berries. And some of them couldn't go very far, couldn't travel well. They should have been found right away, a massive search. They don't find anything.
It's also interesting that no one ever sees anyone get taken. I don't think you have a single case in here where someone sees someone take something or take someone. It seems like they just disappear into thin air, essentially.
Well, I think I said this on George Knapp's show one time, is whatever is happening here is 100% effective. And if you think about that ratio, how could anything related to human activity with a human suspect be 100% effective 1,200 times? I think that's impossible.
Is it possible it's not 100% and we just don't recognize it for what it is?
Well, and then you go back and you think, okay, so I've written about 1,200 cases, but I've probably looked at 5,000 cases that are outside the bounds of the profile. And to me, and to the other people that have read these cases, there isn't something that would be consistent enough to add to the profile that would be a critical part of the disappearance itself. Now, if you think about that weather issue,
mm-hmm.
I talk about it in the book, and I said, well, you know, the United States has been manipulating weather for 50 years, and we can just talk about a minute part of that and say cloud seeding. So at a small level, we can manipulate the weather, and everyone would agree. Now let's think about a greater level of weather manipulation, and then you could talk about HAARP and all the kind of murky information about how HAARP can control the weather to an even greater degree. But then there is also an amendment in the United Nations Charter that says that nations cannot use weather as a factor in war times. Now think about that for a minute. Why would the UN have a charter amendment like that unless there was the ability by someone somewhere to drastically control the weather and thus have an effect on a war?
Yeah. Yeah, that is odd.
So if we can do it and manipulate the weather to that degree, there's probably a lot of things that, you know, governments can do that we don't quite understand yet.
Sure. I think that's kind of a given. The stuff we know that the government can do is probably at least a few decades behind what they can actually do.
Sure.
And the storm thing is also, I mean, it is very weird. You had a case, I believe it was Susan Jackson, who was found dry after a rainstorm.
Yeah, and that one sticks out, and everyone who would read it would say, oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
But those type don't happen that often where it's that blatant that something else is going on. So a small girl disappears from a house. It storms the entire time she's out. She's found out in the middle of a small wooded area that is just absolutely drenched, and she's completely dry, and she doesn't remember anything about what happened. And therein lies another element that we talk about in the profile, is if the people are found, 99.9% of the time, they don't remember where, how they disappeared, where they went, or what happened.
And they're also, you mentioned that they're often found with a slight fever.
Yeah, and that is, I think, in a majority of these cases, that would be true. But the issue is that the victims don't get to a medical facility fast enough to pick up that fever. But in the instances where they do, and the doctors are astute, they mention it. And again, if, say, in a police report, if the policeman didn't go back and actually interview the doctor, he would never even put it in his report. Or if the reporter didn't go to the hospital to interview the victim, it would never be anywhere. It's just in those rare times where there's somebody who's real conscientious that writes down a lot of things that don't seem to be, you know, important, that you pick these things up.
It also seems strange that you don't get people found who have massive injuries. They're either found dead with no obvious cause of death most of the time, or they're found alive and in pretty decent shape, considering.
But there are these cases that I just started to write about in the last few books where people are found at the bottom of a cliff.
Yeah.
And I wanted to edge into that topic because it is unusual. And a couple of things have come about in the last couple of years that we picked up that really point to that as another element that we should be looking at hard. Just because somebody walks into the woods, that does not mean that they're not being careful. And I can honestly tell you in the thousands of hikes I've done in my life, when I'm alone, I'm way more careful looking where I'm going, doing climbing the trail, where I put my feet, than if I'm in a big group of people. If I'm in a big group of people and I break my leg, I know I've got help. But when,
right.
But when you're alone, you don't.
That's true. That's true. And a lot of times when they're found at the bottom of cliffs, it's in places that they weren't actually planning on being in the first place.
Yes. And it surprises people, searchers, when they find them in these locations sometimes. There's a video that we put up, and you can get to it through the YouTube page on our website. But myself and another individual went out to Vail up in central Colorado. And a doctor named James McGrogan, this last winter, was with a group of other physicians, and they were going up a trail in February, I think it was, lots of snow, right across from Vail Ski Resort, right across Highway 70. And as they're about halfway up this trail, somewhere around 10 o'clock, McGrogan, who's an emergency room physician, early 30s, outstanding physical condition, triathlete, marathon runner, he says, hey, I'm not tired, I'm just going to take off, I'll meet you guys at our next stop. So this trail, it's heavily, heavily used. It's like almost like a road. You cannot get lost on it. Well, his physician friends went up to the next stop. He wasn't there. Well, they said, well, maybe he went on. They went to the next stop. He wasn't there. Well, by 5 o'clock that night, they knew something was really wrong. They sent a guy back down. Big search starts. And they search for a week, and they find nothing. They had searchers taking every ski path off of this trail, and they couldn't find him. He was carrying a backpack, and he had what's called split skis on his backpack, meaning they would be a snowboard if you kept them together, or they'd be cross-country skis if you split them up. They had helicopter overflights that went on all week, multiple helicopters. And what they were looking for is tracks through virgin snow. They didn't find any. So 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, some people were two mountain ranges over, 4.5 miles from where he was last seen on that trail, and they find McGrogan at the bottom of this creek, at the bottom of a cliff, dead from head trauma. And at the time, the sheriff's office, Eagle County Sheriff's, looked at the camera and said, "We don't know how he got here." And other people, other search and rescue people said, "We don't know how he got here." Well, we pulled out some maps, and on the video, I show you on the map, and I tell the public that the people are doing these helicopter overflights looking through virgin snow. So if he took air miles, it was 4.5 air miles from point to point, little over 12 miles if he was going to walk it. But we went down and we interviewed the people that rented him the split skis and some of his equipment, and the experts in there said, there's no way someone's going to take that route. And besides that, if he had taken that route, he would have looked like a snowplow going through the middle of the snow and would have been picked up by the helicopters.
Right.
None of that was. Now, this is one of those cases where going the distance pays big dividends. I read all the reports. That's all that was said. And for 3 weeks, I pushed to get a copy of the coroner's report. I finally get the coroner's report. And it says they received the body, and he was wearing a long sleeve shirt, long pants, and no boots. And the boots they searched for him were never recovered.
Wow. And that I think puts a good exclamation point on the missing shoes aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, what else could you say? I called the coroner. I said, "Well, didn't you guys find that interesting or unusual?" "Yeah, we did. That's why we had those people go out and look for the shoes, but they couldn't find them." And I said, "So what was the general condition of his body?" And they said, "Well, he was wearing a helmet, and he had severe trauma so bad that the side of the helmet was bashed in."
Wow.
And with that, part one of the interview with David Politis ends. There is more than an hour left in this interview. I'll be airing it next week. Again, please go sign the petition David was talking about. You can find it at canammissing.com as well as Where Did the Road Go? And that is all I have for you this week. Part two, next week. And to take you out, some Psyche Corporation. Appropriately, this is Nightmares.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. The day I was born, you promised me hellfire. You were so sure I grew up waiting for demons to find me. I grew up hungry for ghosts to define me. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Suffering, offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a song.